I'd like to open today by turning back to Matthew chapter 5. Matthew chapter 5, if you want to head back there. This chapter opens with the Beatitudes, where Jesus Christ is expounding on characteristics and qualities that his true followers would and should seek after. And we know from the context here that his followers were going to have a very hard go of it here in just a very short amount of time. They were going to face some tremendous persecution. They were going to face all kinds of hardship, and generally, it was just going to be a struggle to stay on the course. So let's pick it up in verse 11 of Matthew chapter 5. This is right after the Beatitudes. Matthew chapter 5, verse 11. It says, "Blessed are you when they revile and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you." So if you're going to emulate the way of life that Jesus Christ demonstrated and taught, you are going to stand out. You're going to stand out in that crowd. And at that time, standing out led to trouble for some of those individuals. And in this context, Jesus Christ gives us two examples of what his people are going to be like. Verse 13. It says, "You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It is good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. You are the light of the world," verse 14. "A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven." Now, being the light of the world, I think that's an analogy that I can immediately understand. So light, it cuts through the darkness, as we understand. Light helps you see the path. Light helps illuminate any obstacles. It shows the hidden. We know that Satan's way is darkness. God's way is light. So we see this contrast between the two here. And I think those analogies are pretty clear and easy to follow. But it's a little bit more difficult to think about salt. That's a little harder for me to wrap my mind around. There isn't the same sort of contrast there. You don't say like Satan's way is peppery and God's way is salt. Like that doesn't work at all. Or the way of the world is plain or something like that. None of those analogies fit there. There's no contrast. Maybe it's because, at least for me, maybe I don't get it because I don't like salt. Like, I don't really like the taste of it. I heard a gasp. Like, that's outrageous. When I was 9 or 10, just a little whippersnapper, I had this great idea that since I loved the salt on pretzels, I would go and lick the salt off. I thought, well, it must be the salt that I really love. So I thought, I got a great idea. If I like that a little bit, I bet I like it a lot. So I went into the kitchen. I know, I was there. So I went to the kitchen. I poured this heaping tablespoon of salt. And just in one fell swoop, I put the whole thing in and swallowed it. I know, it was dreadful. It was absolutely dreadful. It was disgusting. I was overwhelmed and not in a positive way at all. And after that, it took me years before I would try salt again. And even now, to this day, when I see people like pouring salt on their things, I just look at them, I think, ugh, that is disgusting. I just don't like it. So is that it? I mean, is that the stuff we're supposed to be? And it gets a little bit more weird, too, when thinking about this analogy. If I described you as being salty, would that be a good thing? I don't know if it would. If I said that person had salty language, like a salty sailor, I don't think you would think that's a compliment. And let's notice something back in Genesis chapter 19. Let's head back there. This is a very familiar story that we're going to go to. Let's pick it up in verse 24 of Genesis chapter 19, verse 24. Genesis 19, verse 24. It says, "Then the Lord rained brimstone and fire on Sodom and Gomorrah." So we're going to remember here in this context that God had pronounced judgment on Sodom and Gomorrah, and Lot and his family, they were living there or in that region at that time, and they had to basically be dragged out before God destroyed this city. and they were pulled from it, very dramatic fashion, and then God started this punishment on the city. So the Lord rained brimstone and fire on Sodom and Gomorrah from the Lord out of the heavens. Verse 25. So he overthrew these cities, all the plains, all the inhabitants of the cities, and what grew on the ground. Verse 26. But his wife looked behind him, and she became a pillar of salt. Well, this is someone that is 100% salt of the earth, so to speak. And this was not a compliment for her. This was not good. I don't think anyone walked up to that statue of salt and thought, wow, Lot's wife really nailed it. I'm glad God made a memorial to her so we can all see that salt is a positive thing. In this case, it's a bad thing. Salt is a negative here. So if we are to be the salt of the earth, what exactly does that mean? Is it a positive thing? I mean, it's got to be a positive thing, right? The first time the phrase salt of the earth is used in the English language that we can track down, it's actually when they were translating this verse in the Bible, back for the Wycliffe Bible, back in 1380. But whether you're religious or not, that phrase has its own kind of vernacular in English nowadays. It usually means someone that is kind of down to earth, someone that's humble, like a hard worker, etc. But I'm going to ask the question again. Is that what Jesus is talking about? Is that what he had in mind when he gave these analogies? Those are all great traits, but is that what Jesus was thinking about, or was that the main idea that Jesus was trying to convey? Today, I'd like to explore this topic together and maybe add a little bit more nuance to the topic. Salt was a very important component in the ancient Near East, and God used that physical tool to show facets of a spiritual concept. In the Bible, salt actually has a handful of different applications and meanings, some of which I never even considered before starting to research this sermon. And by investigating those together, I hope that we can see just how salty we need to be. To that end, we are going to look at salt within the Bible in three different ways and see how we can apply that to our lives as Christians, so that when we say we're the salt of the earth, we know that it's illustrated by these concepts in the Bible. These are the three salted perspectives we are going to cover. Number one, salt is a tool used in judgment. Salt is a tool used in judgment. Number two, salt is a tool for healing. Salt is a tool for healing. And number three, salt is used to highlight an everlasting covenant. Salt is used to highlight an everlasting covenant. And as we go through these three, I think that we'll find there's a little bit more nuance to salt than what might be just on the surface. And to be the salt of the earth kind of people, it's more than just simply being a hard worker, humble worker bee. Let's jump right into example number one. Example number one is salt was used as a tool in judgment. In this aspect, salt usage is one that maybe you hadn't considered before. We already mentioned Lot's wife, where she was turned into a pillar of salt as part of her punishment. But there's more to it than that. Let's go back to Deuteronomy chapter 29. Deuteronomy chapter 29. Now, just to set the stage about what we're going to read here, this is right on the heels of the blessings and cursings chapters, where God made the Israelites march up on the two mountains there, and they shouted back the blessings and cursings of following God's way versus going their own path. There's not a lot of ambiguity. After they were done with this, they understood the two paths. They still had to choose, of course, but they understood. And God is very plainly explaining the pros and cons of each one. In chapter 29, we get a renewal or reiteration of this covenant agreement. Verses 10 of chapter 29, it calls everyone together again just to reiterate more of the point behind those blessings and cursings. And I want to drop down to verse 20. What is the nation? What happens if they agree, but then they renege on it later? What happens if they turn away and the cursings are then brought forth? Deuteronomy 29, starting in verse 20. It says, "The Lord would not spare him, For then the anger of the Lord and his jealousy would burn against that man, and every curse that is written in this book would settle on him. And the Lord would blot out his name from under heaven. So this is pretty bad stuff here. These are not good things. And the Lord would separate him from all the tribes of Israel for adversity, according to all the curses of the covenant that are written in this book of law, so that the coming generation of your children who rise up after you, and the foreigner who comes from a faraway land would say, when they see the plagues on the land and the sickness with which the Lord had laid upon it, in other words, when these punishments come that God brings, what are the other people going to say? What are they going to see when they see the end result of all this stuff? What's going to strike them the most? They're going to say this, quote, 23, the whole land is brimstone, salt, and burning. It's not sown, nor does it bear, nor does any grass grow there, like the overthrown of these four cities, which the Lord overthrew in his anger and his wrath. All the nations would say, why has the Lord done so to this land? What does the heat of his great anger mean? Then the people would say, because they have forsaken the covenant of the Lord God of their fathers, which he made with them when he brought them out of the land of Egypt, for they went and served other gods and worshiped them, gods they didn't know, and he had not brought to them. If the nation turns away and God brings about the curses, the land itself will be punished. So much more so that when people come across it, they would be shocked by what they saw. Something that used to be so fertile and wonderful is now so desolate and destroyed. It would be like brimstone, which is like a sulfury, smelly mess sort of thing. And also, as part of that punishment, salt. Salt throughout. We won't turn back there, but you can jot down Judges chapter 9, verses 45. Judges 9, 45, that talks about Abimelech. When he took a city in warfare, not only did he demolish the city, but then he sowed the ground with salt as part of their punishment. And you might think, well, you know, why did he do that? That's a lot of work to do that. Why did he do it? Well, of course, if the ground is too salty, then it's harder for the food to cultivate, especially the food that you want to grow. And if you take it to an extreme, you can have an area like the Great Salt Flats in America or the Dead Sea over in that area where literally nothing can grow at all. That's an extreme of it. And historically, we do have all sorts of accounts from other nations outside of Israel that would do this very same thing when they come in and conquer an area. They would destroy the city. They would tear down all the buildings. They would break down all the walls. They would destroy and burn everything they can. But then if they didn't plan on living in that conquered area, they would often do two things. They would go take rocks and salt and spread them all around the area where they were at. Because if you were to come back later as a conquered people, you can rebuild your houses, you can stack back up your wall, but if you can't farm, and if you can't grow the food that you need, you're going to be in a lot more tricky of a spot. I want to notice an example back in Zephaniah chapter 2. Zephaniah chapter 2. It's not that they just brought in truckloads of salt and they dumped it on the barley harvest or something like that. They didn't have that capability back then. But what they did do actually was a little bit worse. We see a hint of it here in Zephaniah, and it's actually a way that salt was used to punish an area for a very long time. Zephaniah chapter 2 and verse 8 is where we'll start. Zephaniah 2, starting in verse 8. Zephaniah 2, 8 says, I have heard the reproach of Moab and the insults of the people of Ammon, with which they have reproached my people and made arrogant threats against their borders. Therefore, as I live, says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, surely Moab shall be like Sodom, and the people of Ammon like Gomorrah, overrun with weeds and salt pits. Okay, keep that in mind. That's kind of a very specific curse there. Overrun with weeds and salt pits, and a perpetual desolation. It's going to last a long time. The residue of my people shall plunder them, and the remnant of my people shall possess them. This they shall have for their pride, because they have reproached and made arrogant threats against the people of the Lord of hosts. So what this is describing here, and we have at least five other extra-biblical examples of other people doing this, is they would come in and they would lay the land to waste. They would tear up the farmable area, and in its place, they would put salt and weeds together. This is actually a very early form of biological warfare, believe it or not. You don't have to make the land as salty as the Dead Sea. They couldn't do that even if they wanted to. But rather, they would increase the salinity, and they would put in weeds that thrive in that environment. And the end result is the exact same. By the time they came back, they had no real farmable land that they could use. And some of these, we have an account of one. It was a proto-Hittite king. He did the same thing, and he used a type of weed called the greater darnel. And I hope I don't have this in my yard, but in our garden this year, I felt like we did. And he would go in, and he sowed it all across any of the usable land that they had there, and it can lie fallow in the ground for several years. And then when you come back and you start to plow the field to plant, then it's activated, it grows up, and it chokes out all of the other crops that you want to actually grow. And some of these instances that we have, it takes a tremendous amount of effort to restore the soil. Sometimes multiple generations went by before they could get it back to the way it was. So this is what it's talking about here. And in these cases, salt itself wasn't the punishment. It was the tool used to facilitate the real punishment. That's what we're talking about here. Salt is used as a tool for punishment. Okay, so let's keep this one in the back of our minds here, because remember, Jesus said that we have to be the salt of the earth. So this is part of what it means. There's more to it. Let's go to example number two. Example number two is on the opposite end of the salt spectrum. Salt is also used as a tool for healing. As a tool for healing. I want to notice a comment that God made in Ezekiel chapter 16. You can turn back there. Ezekiel chapter 16. This chapter, God is talking about how he cared for Israel when they were a floundering infant nation, and how he has guided them and protected them. And in this analogy, notice how God uses salt, or the lack of salt in this case, as an illustration for an infant that was not cared for or was not attended to properly and left in harm's way. Ezekiel chapter 16, we'll start right in verse 1. Ezekiel 16 and verse 1. It says, "Again, the word of the Lord came to me, saying this, 'Son of man, cause Jerusalem to know her abominations, and say, Thus says the Lord God to Jerusalem, Your birth and your nativity are from the land of Canaan. Your father was an Amorite and your mother a Hittite. As for your nativity, on the day you were born, your navel cord was not cut.'" So here he's talking about positive actions that should have happened for an infant that was cared for, but didn't happen here. "Your navel cord was not cut, nor were you washed in water to cleanse you. You were not rubbed with salt. You were not rubbed with salt, nor wrapped in swaddling cloths. No, I pitied you to do any of these things for you, to have compassion on you. But you were thrown out in the open field where you yourself were loathed on the day you were born." He's saying no one cared about this infant nation enough to provide the positive things that you would do for a baby that was born. If someone were to care for it, it would have done all these loving actions, including washing them and rubbing with salt. Salt here is a positive thing, used in a positive way, as a benefit to help the newborn at birth. Years ago, before we had kids, Sarah and I, we went to the feast in Israel in Jordan. And one of the places we went to was the Dead Sea. And the Dead Sea is absolutely famous as like a healthy area to go. You see people rubbing the mud all over themselves, not drinking the water, just the mud. And the sea is, of course, very famous for being extremely salty. It's very salty. It's over 9 times saltier than the regular ocean. And one of the side effects of the water is that it's so dense with salt that you can't sink even if you want to. And so we would try. We would go kind of go down, shoot ourselves down in the water as far as you can, and you just come popping right back up again because it's so dense. It was a very strange feeling. But as we were about ready to visit the Dead Sea, our tour guide came up to us and he said, make sure that you have no cuts on your body at all. Like, women, do not shave your legs. Men, do not shave. Just let it go. You're going to be fine. You don't want any nicks or scrapes on you at all. Because, of course, if you're going to go in that water, the salt water is going to be very refreshing. Maybe in a very painful sort of way. The salt reacts to any open wound or cut like no one's business. And it hurts. It hurts. But salt can have a cleaning effect on the wounds as well. Probably not the Dead Sea water. I don't think that's a sterile source or anything like that. But even up to World War I, dry gauze packed in salt was the standard issue for caring for wound care out in the field. And you can search WebMD when you get home and see all sorts of uses, even in modern days, for how salt can help all sorts of various ailments. They have a whole section on their website that's entitled Healthy Uses for Salt. And it goes down and ticks through a whole checklist of medical issues, even today, that can be benefited by applying salt. Hippocrates, or as if you were to say his name just as it's written, Hippocrates, he lived a few hundred years before Jesus Christ, and he's widely regarded as the father of medicine. And he wrote all sorts of these treatises on salts and all the medical uses that salts had in your various ailments. But more than the physical applications of salt, God uses salt symbolically for healing as well. Let's go to 2 Kings chapter 2. 2 Kings chapter 2. This is in the transition period between Elijah and Elisha. And Elisha is literally picking up Elijah's mantle, and he's being established as the next main prophet in Israel. We're going to go to chapter 2. Chapter 2 starts out with Elijah going away. Elijah's performing many miracles here. And we're going to jump into the story. 2 Kings chapter 2, verse 19. 2 Kings 2, verse 19. It says, Then the men of the city said to Elijah, please notice that the situation of this city is pleasant, as my Lord sees. But, you know, the water's bad. The ground is pretty barren. Things are great, don't mean to complain, but, you know, the water sucks. So he said to him, bring me a new bowl and put salt in it. So they brought it to him, and he went out to the water source, and he cast the salt there and said this, thus says the Lord, I have healed this water, and from it there shall be no more death or barrenness. So the water remained healed to this day according to the word of Elijah which he spoke. Now, that's clearly counterintuitive there, and clearly a miracle that God uses to clean a water source. For the observers, it would have demonstrated two things. First, that God was the source of this miracle, of course. Just a simple salt couldn't permanently clean a water source like this. And secondly, and more to our point, salt was illustrative as something that heals, a tool that heals. So here, salt is a good thing. Salt is a tool used in healing. So we've seen that salt can be used as a tool in judgment, and salt can be used as a tool of healing. Two very different applications. But again, we have to keep this in mind as we come back to what Jesus said. Before we do, though, we have one more example of how salt is used in the Bible, and maybe one of the most interesting and, for me, overlooked areas about salt. The third example of salt is how it's an indicator of a long-lasting covenant. An indicator of a long-lasting covenant. For this, I want to go back to Leviticus chapter 2. Leviticus chapter 2. The inspiration for this sermon came from Sarah, where all good ideas come from. She's reading through a book about Leviticus, and she came across an observation that neither one of us, regardless of how many times we've read through Leviticus, neither one of us have ever really noticed this before. It's one of the really great things about the Bible. You can pick up new things all the time. The early part of Leviticus focuses on the different offerings that Israel could perform. Chapter 1 is the burnt offering. Chapter 2 is the grain offering. We have sin offerings, so on and so forth. And for each one of these offerings, it talks about how you prepare it, like what you bring for it, how it's offered, who gets to eat it, you name it, all the technical parts of an offering. And I want to pick it up in chapter 2, verse 11 now. This is the tail end of talking about the grain offering. Leviticus 2, again, starting in verse 11. Leviticus 2, 11. It says, "No grain offering which you bring to the Lord shall be made with leaven, for you shall burn no leaven, nor any honey in any offering to the Lord made by fire. As for the offering of the first fruits, you shall offer them to the Lord, but they shall not be burned on the altar for a sweet aroma." Okay, now get this next part. These are a lot of technical details about the offering. Verse 13, "And every offering of your grain offering you shall season with salt, and you shall not allow the salt of the covenant." This is unusual. "The salt of the covenant of your God to be lacking from your grain offering. Moreover, with all your offerings, you shall offer salt." Okay, that's kind of interesting. That's something I'd never noticed before. You don't have to turn back there, but in Ezekiel chapter 43, you can jot that down. That's a vision of the future temple, again, when offerings are going to be described. And in verse 24, it reiterates that you don't forget the salt with your offerings. That's a key part. It says, quote, "The priests shall throw salt on them." Salt was a very important component in all of the offerings made to God. To me, that's a little bit unusual. Why would salt matter in any of those offerings? It's not to make it tastes better for the priests or something like that, because salt was included on all the offerings, even the ones that were completely consumed, where no human took part of eating it. One more, Numbers chapter 18. Numbers chapter 18, we'll read just a single verse here, verse 19. Numbers chapter 18, verse 19. We're catching this verse here on the tail end of offerings that supported the priest. Numbers 18, in verse 19, it says, "All the heave offerings of the holy things which the children of Israel offer to the Lord, I have given to you," that is the priest here, "and your sons and daughters with you as an ordinance forever. It is a covenant of salt forever before the Lord with you and your descendants with you." Now, salt has always been a very important method of preservation for the vast majority of mankind's existence. If you couldn't figure out how to preserve food, you were going to be in trouble really quick. Food has this pesky problem of not always growing exactly when you need to eat. And so it's hard for us to visualize now when we can head down to the grocery store and get blueberries in the dead of winter. But for the vast majority of mankind, if you couldn't preserve your food, you were going to be in trouble. Sailors would never have been able to cross large bodies of water without salt preserving their food. Any areas that had a long winter would have been nearly impossible without salt-preserved food. Salt was a key mechanism for this preservation. Biblically, salt is used to illustrate the same concept of preservation in making something long-lasting. A salt covenant is a long-lasting and ideally an everlasting and preserved covenant, one that does not decay or degrade. Remember the covenant God made with King David, where he said that if you and your descendants follow my way of life, that your rule will go on forever. They made a covenant together. How do you suppose that covenant was described? 2 Chronicles 13, verse 5. 2 Chronicles 13, verse 5. 2 Chronicles 13, verse 5, it says, "Should you not know that the Lord God of Israel gave the dominion over Israel to David forever, to him and his sons, by a covenant of salt?" By a covenant of salt. This idea of salt symbolizing a long-lasting friendship or commitment even continues in some cultures today. There's an Arabic saying that translates loosely to, like, "there is bread and salt between us," that's even used nowadays. There's a close, respectful relationship between the two parties that we hope is long-lasting. Back in 1995, NASA sent some astronauts up to the Mir space station. This was before the International Space Station. This was not too long after the Berlin Wall fail, and there was tensions between the U.S. and Russia, as hard as that is to believe. And so there was this big spectacle where they put the Americans, and they blasted off. They traveled up to the Mir space station. They docked. They got them in there. And then there was the ceremony where the Russian cosmonauts came out to meet the Americans. And what do you think they gave them? Bread and salt. That was the gift they gave them to symbolize what everyone hoped would be a long-lasting, beneficial partnership between two nations. Salt is used to symbolize something that is long-lasting or even something permanent to the covenant that God made with the Israelites, one that never goes away, never rots, never fades, but one that is as solid and as fresh as the day it was entered into. And each offering was to include salt as a reminder of that enduring covenant between the offerer and our God. So now we have salt used as punishment, healing, and a covenant relationship. How do we put all three of these different ideas together so that we can understand what Jesus is talking about when he says that we have to become the salt of the earth? Now, I want to go back and look at these three usages and read what Jesus Christ actually said. We started in Matthew chapter 5. That's one instance where it was recorded, but it's not the only one. It's recorded in all three of the Synoptic Gospels, but in each version, it's a little bit different. And each time, there's a slightly different emphasis. So let's go back and reread the first one, Matthew chapter 5. I know we started off with this, but I want to get it back in our minds as fresh. And we're going to look at it a little closer. Matthew chapter 5, starting in verse 13. Matthew 5, 13 says, "You are the salt of the earth, but if salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It's good for nothing, but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men." Then notice how it's connected here with the next verse. Verse 14, "You are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket." No, they don't do that. "But on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Therefore, let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven." Okay, so we have two connection points here. Salt of the earth, light of the world. These two concepts, since they're paired like that, we can use one to kind of help understand the other one. So from this perspective, we can see that being salty in this way makes you visible. Makes you visible. It should be obvious to others around you that we're standing out or intending to stand out like a light on the hill. So whatever salt means here, it has to be obvious and visible to everyone else around us. It can't be hidden away. Let's hold on to that just for a second. Let's go to Mark chapter 9. This is the other time, or one of the other times that Jesus says this. We're going to start in verse 49. Mark chapter 9, starting in verse 49. Now, leading up to this verse, it's different than what's in Matthew. Verse 40 talks about whoever is not against us is on our side. Verses 43 through 48 says if something causes you to sin, you got to cut it off. Quite extreme, talking about really focusing on getting rid of sinful desires that are bogging you down. And then we get to verse 49, Mark 9, 49. "For everyone will be seasoned with fire, and every sacrifice will be seasoned with salt." Another connection with salt and sacrifices. "Salt is good, but if the salt loses flavor, how will you season it? Therefore," you could say, or "because of these things, have salt in yourselves and have peace with one another." Okay. Well, whereas before it was salt and light being an example in some way, now we have to have salt within ourselves as it's connected with having peace with one another. Is that what it's talking about with everyone being seasoned with salt? How does that work? Finally, one more. Luke chapter 14. This is the last time Jesus brought it up that's recorded. Luke chapter 14, this is now verse 34 and 35. This time again, totally different context. Now Jesus was talking about counting the cost of becoming a disciple. The previous verse ends with, "Whoever does not forsake all cannot be my disciple." That's the context of this one. And now verse 34. Luke 14, verse 34 says, "Salt is good. Maybe that's our most simple saying so far. Salt is good, but if the salt has lost its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It is neither fit for the land nor for the dunghill, but men throw it out. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. Okay, we have ears to hear. We're trying to learn here. So what do these three things have in common? How does it jive with what we understand salt was used to illustrate throughout the Bible? Let's start with what they have in common. In all three accounts, it is mentioned that if salt loses its flavor, then it becomes worthless. There's quite a few commentaries that suggest that when Jesus said this, it was kind of like a pointed barb at the community a little bit, and that Jesus was basically saying that the Jewish community, if they ceased being what they were supposed to be, then they're destined to be thrown out. And in a physical sense, though, salt can't really lose its flavor. Salt is a chemical compound. It tastes that way because of the chemical compound. So if salt is no longer salty, that means it's no longer salt. It means it's been mixed or watered down or diluted with foreign material, and it's not just salt. It's other stuff now. In other words, it's no longer what it's designed to be. It's forsaken its intended purpose, and therefore, it's lost its value. One of the takeaways for us today that is continuing to call to mind just how valuable we are to God, and how we have a meaningful part with God in what He is doing on the earth right now. He has called us, separated us out from the world, and expects us to model the relationship and the example of Jesus Christ. Not that we're perfect and never make any mistakes. It's never about that. That's ridiculous. But to hold fast to the conviction that God has given us a down payment of what is to come through His Holy Spirit, and we have an intended purpose and a call to action right now. If we have salt within us and our examples can be seen by others like lights on a hill, then we are demonstrating what a relationship with God is designed to look like. Someone that has hope in God's promises through His everlasting covenant. Someone who is patient and kind and therefore seeks peace with one another. Someone that is living God's way of life so that others can see that character and instinctively know there's something different about that person. There's something about the way they live that's different. They are salty people, but in a different way. Salt in the Old Testament pointed to all of those things. It's a complex analogy demonstrating just how multifaceted being a Christian really is. I really like at the end of Luke chapter 14 and verse 35, that's the last one we read, that it says that when salt is no longer salt, it's not even good for the dunghill, which is a fun word to say. They used salt as a fertilizer in the ancient Near East, especially for a handful of crops that thrived in a little saltier soil, but you only needed a little tiny bit. So if you were a farmer and you went out and you purchased this salt to improve your crops, to improve the yield, and you only got it back and you found out it wasn't actually salt, that instead it was corrupted or diluted down so that you couldn't even use it, then you have something that is far worse than what you started with. If that was the case, you have something that should have been additive, something that would have helped your crops, helped your yield, and instead you have something that's subtracted. Now it's just even more than worthless because now you have to deal with this thing and get rid of it. It's a great reminder to myself that if I call myself a Christian, which I do, and I'm not acting like a Christian, which sometimes I do, then what value am I bringing to God's plan here on the earth? Not much, if that's the case. If I'm going to be a Christian and really be the true salt, then I have to be ready for His intended purpose and act upon it. In conclusion, I want to turn back to Colossians chapter 4. Colossians chapter 4. This is at the end of the letter. It's kind of a final summary of some of the ideas that Paul wanted to communicate to his audience. Colossians chapter 4, starting in verse 2. Colossians 4, starting in verse 2. It says, "Continue earnestly in prayer, being vigilant in it with thanksgiving. meanwhile praying also for us that God would open to us a door for the word to speak to the mystery of Christ, for which I am also in chains, that I may make it manifest as I ought to speak. Walk in wisdom towards those who are outside, redeeming the time. Let your speech always be with grace, seasoned with salt, that you may know how you ought to answer each one. When your language is seasoned with salt, that doesn't mean it's filled with colorful language to spice up your stories. It means something completely different. The seasoning with salt here is mentioned with the explicit purpose of knowing how to answer those that call upon you and how to respond and what you respond with, your tone, your language, your example, your prior history, and so on. Because when you are incorporating salt, you have an attitude of demonstrating godly character that convicts the sinner, encourages, supports, and heals the brokenhearted, and highlights to all those around you what it means to have a long-lasting, permanent covenant relationship with the Creator of the universe. It's kind of interesting to me that when people think of the salt of the earth, like Jesus Christ is asking us to be, they often think about characteristics of humble and a hard worker. In my mind, I don't know why, but I always visualize just a farmer out in a field with his head down, just a quiet Christian leader. And of course, all those are wonderful things. But when Jesus Christ made this analogy to his audience, they might have been thinking in a slightly different way than that. Through the use of salt in the Old Testament, they might have come away with a totally different vision of what this salt of the earth person might look like and how to become one themselves. Salt was used as a tool of judgment. We as Christians don't carry out punishment, obviously, but we do live discerningly as testimony in word and actions of the right way of life. And that can bring about a conviction of sin in others as they see our example and how our word and deeds point to a different way of life. Salt was used as a tool for healing. Perhaps this is one of the most relevant ones this time of year when thinking about trumpets and atonement in the millennium, when a tremendous amount of healing that will be required when those days come about. And that healing, while it might be painful at first for some, is through God's way of life, through that relationship. Of course, we'll be teaching this in the millennium, but we're modeling it right now. And salt was also used within offerings as a sign of the covenant. Likewise, we model a spiritual covenant that we made with God through baptism. Our behavior, our character demonstrates the benefits of this covenant to others and serves as a reminder of the everlasting covenant we have made with the everlasting God. When we put it all together, being the salt of the earth is really more nuanced than a simple visual that can be boiled down to a hard-working farmer. Instead, it's a hard-working Christian. It's a hard-working Christian, working diligently on their spiritual lives, individually and collectively within our spiritual family. Being the salt of the earth means to grow the spiritual character to model Jesus Christ, to be an example that Jesus can be proud to point to and say, look at my brothers and sisters here and how we're all moving in the same direction. So let us go forth, salty like never before, as we model Jesus Christ in the world at large.